Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Thank you. Gentlemen and Duns coming.
Today's guest, stand-up comedian, author, co-host of the podcast The Jams, Moshe Kasher. We talk about race, hip-hop, and liberals. And please, go to BurtBurtBurt.com, pre-order my book, Life of the Party, and get a Burt Out Machine shirt.
This is The BurtCast.
Hello, it's recording.
My most anticipated podcast.
Come on.
We've been working on this how long?
That's true. We have had a very difficult time. And then I come to your door, and the first thing I see is a fucking Santa Claus and a sign that says, "We believe," which I felt was directed at me.
Oh, you know what's so funny? I thought when my wife got that, I thought it was racist.
Oh, really?
We've had it as long as I've fucking known her. And when she first put it up, I was like, "We believe" almost says like, "Hey guys, we're on the right team." And she was
like, "But the Santa Claus puts it into a realm of the adorable, right?"
Yeah.
I mean, if it was Jesus,
that's who I thought it was. Yeah, exactly. No. It's so funny because I really feel like I know you very well, although I don't. Only because I feel like I discovered you before anyone else did.
Oh shit!
I saw your Aspen clip.
Oh, yeah.
Time ago, you did a rooftop comedy festival, and I was like, this guy's fucking hilarious.
Oh, that's nice. And then, that was sort of the clip that I guess I started my career on.
But I also want to say, like, in a weird way, this is, I'm just making sure I'm recording this talk.
Yeah, hey,
okay,
Moshe Kasher.
Good. Yeah. So, but in a weird way, it was at the time where there were lines drawn in the sand, it seemed like, with alternative comedy and regular comedy.
Yeah,
and
you know, I've always felt those lines were made by somebody else. I don't quite know who.
I always feel like I have the fucking physique of a tight end, so people look at me
right.
Like I'm a fucking meathead. So I always felt like I was on the other side of it. I was in like the regular comedy camp, but the comedy I like is like more alternative in nature. I like funny comedy.
Sure, everybody. I mean, I started in San Francisco, so I always all the alt guys in San Francisco would play the clubs, and all the club guys would go try to play the alt shows.
Yeah.
So I've always considered, I think my comedy really rests right in the middle of club and alt. Like, I've always felt that. Like,
but you look alt.
I definitely look more alternative than my comedy. I mean, I think my comedy really is in the middle. I mean, it's right.
But you have had a really interesting, life.
I've had an alternative lifestyle, not homosexuality. Although, you know, the future, who knows? I'm in your man cave right now. Who knows?
But you're like, it's almost like you expect to come in listening to the Smiths or the new Morrissey acoustic album, but that you love hip hop.
Oh, that's what I grew up on. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I like all that other stuff too, but I didn't get introduced to the Smiths and like alternative rock and stuff. I mean, I guess I listen to like Nirvana because I'm from, you know, kid from the 90s, but
yeah.
No, I was raised on hip hop, on gangster rap, actually, like most specifically gangster rap, but also hip hop in general.
Can I tell you something that I believe? I am obsessed. I got into an argument with my friend the other night, and I said the N-word is, and by the way, I say the N-word. I don't use the word.
That's funny you mention that, because up on your wall here in the man cave is Richard Pryor's album Bicentennial Nigger, and it says nigger. I mean, it's undeniable, and I wonder if that's a way you could get away with saying the N-word, is just you go like, "Oh, I'm really a big fan of Richard Pryor's Bicentennial Nigger." Like, can you do that? Like, what are you supposed to do if that's the title? Are you supposed to say, what would you say? Would you say Bicentennial N-word?
I won't even talk about it. it's so funny because who did I have in here? I had a black guy in here the other day, And he was like looking at it, and he was like, it's interesting that you have it up in your man cave.
I mean, it's prominently displayed.
Yeah.
To be fair, it's not the only one. Yeah. That would be hilarious if it was the only album.
And then I had NWA up there. Yeah. But NWA, when that came out, I want to say that brought that word, that ingratiated it in a weird way to youths like myself and you.
Yeah.
Like, because someone said to me the other day, I'm not allowed to sing it.
Sing
the N-word. Like, when it's in a song,
I hear what you're
I'm
saying.
Not allowed
right.
to sing it. And I'm like, I'm in my car by myself. No one's going to hear me.
Right, but immorally, God's watching.
Yeah,
if we truly believe, Santa's watching and he's real mad.
But yeah, hip-hop.
You did say the N-word.
Hip-hop defined me.
Oh, is that right? Oh, you grew up on hip-hop?
Hardcore.
Oh, interesting.
But Southern hip-hop.
Where are you from?
Tampa.
Okay, so Luke?
I met Uncle Luke. I was having dinner with Emilio Estefan, Gloria Estefan's husband,
okay.
The producer.
That could have gone in a different direction, Estevez, at any moment, but go ahead.
I'm having dinner with Emilio Estefan, and we're shooting Travel Channel's Trip Flip, and Uncle Luke walks
cool.
up, and I lost my shit.
I could get
Uncle
that.
Luke! And he's like, and he looks at me, I'm a fucking 40-year-old, I'm a man, I'm a grown man.
Yeah.
And it must be the weirdest thing for him to see that and go, oh, all right, yeah.
I had a similar situation. I was on a Southwest flight, and just to show you where my career is at, but I was, you know, Southwest, it's open seating,
yeah.
And this big, like, thug kind of looking dude comes in, and he's holding an entire row, and I was just like, what a jerk, like, this,
yeah.
You can't just do that. He's like, no, keep going, and like 1 minute before the door's supposed to close, E-40 song comes in.
Shut up!
Yeah, and this guy had been like holding, and why is E-40 flying Southwest? I don't know.
No, I'm
but,
I haven't heard him on an album since MJG and 8-Ball.
Yeah, all right. We're going very deep into the coffers.
Dude, MJG and 8-Ball, and no disrespect to MJG, 8-Ball specifically is a dream guest of mine.
Was he the fat one? Or
the big guy.
Yeah. So E-40 comes in, and I freak out, you know, I go, and you, your listeners don't know what I look like, but like, I know how the N word you can't say. I look like the F word, right? So I just, you know, I've
got, with a sprinkle of the J word.
That's right. So I have like, you know, I got poofy hair and big nerd glasses, and you know, I dress a little bit flamboyantly sometimes. Anyway, I just go, I lean in, and I just go, excuse Mr. Water or Mr. 40, I'm huge fan.
Howdy.
And he just goes, like, you could feel him like dismissing me, like,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Because, like, E-40 had, he had a hit in the last 10 years. He had that hyphy song, I think. And so he probably assumed that I had just heard about him from MTV in that last year or whatever. So then I go, I've been a fan of yours since Federal, which is his first album, which is like, you know, nobody knew who he was back then.
Well, he's from where you grew up.
Yeah, and people, probably your listeners don't even know who he is now, but he's now big, and at the time, like, he was an underground sensation, like people would. So I go, when I said Federal, I saw the lights kind of go on in his eyes. Like, he was, I could tell, like, I'm sure Luke felt the same way, like, intrigued that this weird, like, you know, gay-looking white boy was, like, talking about, like, a very obscure first album of his. And then he was just like, yeah? And he, like, leaned in and got all into it. And I assume I made his day.
It's weird. You want them to know. Like, I ran into, when I first moved out to LA, I was living in a hotel. And I was doing a TV show, and I went to a Dodgers game. I got fucking hammered. I roll up and to my hotel, and out front, I mean, unmistakable. I saw, the second I saw him, Juvie and fucking Lil Wayne.
Oh, in your hotel.
Juvie and Lil Wayne sitting outside smoking. And I walked up. I was like, Juvenile. I was like, I'm a
you
huge
ignored
fucking...
Lil Wayne completely.
Lil Wayne wasn't... To be honest with you, this is all fairness. This is 15 years ago.
Oh, he wasn't as big.
He wasn't as big. No, and not even my favorite rapper.
Right.
Like, I love Juvie. I thought he was like... Lil Wayne had some of the hottest lyrics on that... They did that Hot Boys album.
Uh-huh.
He had some of the hottest lyrics. But like, if it would have been BG... Like, BG had written Bling Bling. So if it had been BG, I would have fucking lost my shit.
I just picture all of your viewers one by one turning their iPhones off. Like,
fuck them. You know what? We'll bring it back. You want to really talk interesting shit? I spent the night last night Googling black fraternity brandings.
Oh, and what does that mean? Brandings? I know what the black...
They brand each other.
Oh, no shit.
With fucking
Whoa.
Iron. and
that's
just
crazy.
It's the most insane like ritual. Black fraternities are take fraternity to the next level.
Yeah, I've seen somebody get branded before.
Really?
Yeah, at Burning Man, I saw this guy. It was very weird. This guy had like a little.
You went to Burning Man?
I've been like 13 times. But,
seriously?
Yeah, I go every year. I've been going since I was like 16. But which we can get into. But this guy had a little teeny,
oh
I mean
God.
Small, like hand like rolled kiln. I think maybe it's on the back of a motorcycle. Actually, it was like a very small kiln that he was like stoking. Like I don't know how it was being powered, but and then he had this teeny little brand that he was heating up in this kiln. Or I guess it's a, you know it's like it was like a
yeah.
whatever. And then he was just going around. Does anybody want this? And people would walk up, and it was a Burning Man symbol, which you don't want to do that to yourself. It's
yeah.
a bad decision to make. But yeah, right in front of me, this guy was like, "I'll do it." And they just like he just sort of touched it to him. It was pretty intense.
We branded ourselves with Omegas. On our arms, we saw the black guys do it,
yeah.
but there were little tiny ones that we had gotten at like a craft store.
Uh-huh.
Like it was like
you
a
really did it.
It was we really did it, but they it went. You got it. The thing is, black people scar different
right.
than white people.
Right,
they have those keloids.
Jews too, you know?
Really?
Yeah, Jews keloid. Black people, Jews, and yeah, it's just white people. They got real white people. They got away with it.
Yeah, I got branded, but it went away, and then I got shot there by a paint pellet gun uh-huh. one time, and it. Scarred over it, and then it just disappeared. Now it doesn't even look like anything.
Yeah.
So wait. Yeah. Hip hop for me. I remember I used to listen to hip hop. I listened to like. There was a song Baseline. But it was a real long time ago. But it was like I think it was like Nucleus or something. And I used to listen to that. And when girls would call, I'd change it and put on reggae so that they thought I was cool. Uh-huh. And then I'd be like, hey, what's up? No, they're just listening to music.
When girls call me, I put on Richard Pryor's Bicentennial Nigger. Just
It's so funny. I had to stop listening to hip-hop because of my daughters
yeah.
I got the new Kendrick Lamar.
It's so good.
I haven't been able to listen to it because hip-hop is best listened to in a car.
Yeah,
it
sure.
is music made for. It's really interesting the way people make music these days. You mm-hmm. know, like Dr. Dog is a. I'm a pretty eclectic kind of music guy.
Sure, that's so the like, that's the combination of Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dog, right?
Right,
yeah.
Dr. Dog.
Yeah, Dr. Dog, their new album.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's like more like an acoustic, but he's better to listen to like on a plane when you're drinking.
Interesting.
You know, like yeah, like my wife used to. There was like a moratorium if there was no Irish music to be played ever. At night,
because you would get too drunk,
I'd start fucking putting them back. Irish music, just fucking That's throwing hilarious. Them back. But hip hop is best listened to in a car, and I can't listen because I always have my girls in the car. And I was listening to Kendrick Lamar and one song, and it was just like he was dropping the N-word a lot. And I was like, my daughters are gonna fucking hear this.
Right, I hear you. I mean, Kendrick is not very ignorant. I mean,
yeah,
that's my problem with rap. As I get older, I'm 34. I've been listening to hip hop since I was, I don't know, 13. Like avidly since I was 13 and sort of totally since I was like 8, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it became like my defining music when I was younger. I was like maybe I would go rock. I was like it was a turning, you know, should I go rock Guns N' Roses and in that direction, or should I go towards hip? Those are sort of, you know, I was white but I did live in Oakland, so it was sort of the bifurcation of my two identities.
Yeah.
And I eventually went towards hip hop, but I'm now, you know, I've been listening to it for a long time. I'm a grown up, and I think consider myself slightly enlightened or whatever. Like, I'm just mature, just like you are. And it's like, I don't feel like hip-hop has, and this is a little bit, you know, I don't want to brand all hip-hop, but I just feel like in general, hip-hop hasn't really evolved. Like, it's one big evolution was that they stopped talking about murder as much after Biggie and Tupac died. You know what I mean? But that was their big allowance for humanity. It was like, okay,
yeah.
we'll switch over to materialism and money. And it's just like, at a certain point, I've heard about how dope these guys are for so long. It's like, oh, is there? Oh, there's a new fellow that's very dope and the best rapper and
yeah.
has all the money. It's like, it's misogynistic and materialistic, and I get tired of it a little bit. But Kendrick, I actually feel like it has something to say.
I had a point when I was like listening to T.I. and I was like, he just got into ecstasy. Like,
oh yeah. Well, black dudes hit ecstasy way later than white dudes.
Yeah,
white people had ecstasy for a long time. You know, I mean, that's actually, you know, it comes jazz. And hip-hop and the blues and rock and roll, all of these things are things that black people invented and then white people stole and appropriated. Ecstasy? Techno? That was ours. Well, actually, techno, black people invented techno. But ecstasy,
yeah,
that wheat was ours. And then then black guys got on board.
That's the one thing we've given to them. Right. They're like, shut up.
Molly? Y'all look at the Molly?
Models, bottles, mollies, blunts.
That's what I'm saying is like, you know, Drake, not that Drake is the most enlightened human being in the world, but he's like the hottest guy right now, right?
What did I watch? I just watched Drake in something last night.
Degrassi?
Was that? No, I don't know. Was he in Degrassi High?
He started in Degrassi High, yeah.
Shut up!
Yeah, and that's so people talk shit about Drake. And I'm saying, Drake is not, it's not like he's enlightened. He's still talking about like women and cocaine. I don't know what he's talking about, the truth is. But he's like soft, you know, yeah. That's his thing. He's like a sensitive kind of guy. And everybody's just like, you know, talking shit about him. Like, oh, you ain't no real gangster. You're soft. It's like, can we have, it's been 30 years. Can we have one, yeah. Are we allowed to have one superstar that isn't talking about, you know, how tough and from the streets he is? Like, who gives a shit? So anyway, I just got tired of like every hip hop song is about a single, not everyone, but almost every hip hop song is about its author.
Yeah,
it's like, well, you know, then you listen to Dr. Dog or Bob Dylan, it's like, oh, you can have songs about like topics, and I sort of feel like Kendrick does that.
I feel like when I first saw stand up, I remember thinking, I'm hesitant to even use real names because when I first saw stand-up, it seemed like people were one thing. Say Jim Norton was like the dead prostitute in the trunk guy.
Uh-huh, right.
And then Godfrey was like the high energy friendly guy, and right. And like it's when I first saw it, I felt like everyone was, I felt like I was looking at people compartmentalized, and I was like, what kind of comic am I going to be?
Uh-huh.
Right. And then I was like, why can't I just be me? And do all of it, and be like more like a utility player, and then I realized I was not good at doing what Jim did. I wasn't good at doing what Godfrey did. I couldn't do what fucking Jim Gaffigan did. I couldn't be clean. So I was just like, well, fuck. I guess you just find your voice,
right? Or your voice finds you.
Your voice
finds.
Yeah,
that's sort of how I feel. I feel like, you know, they say to young comics like you just have to get on stage. That's the whole thing. And it's like, but some people talk about that. They mean like, oh, you got to be comfortable or get your hours in, which is definitely true. But it's also like, you just have to stand there for long enough for you to go, oh, this is the comic that I am. Like, eventually, yeah. Just one day you go like, oh, I'm this guy. I didn't even know. I've just been writing towards my whatever is funny to me. And then eventually you go, oh, I'm the guy that talks in this way and says this stuff and is, you know. So I call myself, my voice, the conqueror. No, I'm just kidding.
No. Wait, I haven't seen you do stand-up in a while, and you had this big run in Montreal that you did.
Yeah, I just did.
Well, because we'd run into each other in the elevator.
That's right, yeah.
What was that like?
That was cool, man. Did you do New Faces?
I've never done New Faces. I don't know what I did. I don't know what... I just did some... Well, no, New Faces was... I was in Deals, but when New Faces was right. around. I don't even think they do it anymore.
Right.
But I did something. I don't know what I did.
Well, they, like, you know, when you're a young comic, you know, like, unestablished, your kind of dream is to get Montreal Just for Laughs Festival New Faces.
So yeah.
It's a showcase of... I know you know this. I'm just telling the people that don't. Like, you know, it's a showcase of, like, all the hottest people that they've selected. So you go... And it's very uncomfortable. It's a very uncomfortable experience. You're like, you know, you're selected and you're like, oh, it's the biggest deal ever. And it is in some way. And then you just go and you do these like rapid fire 7-minute sets in front of like, you know, audiences that are good sometimes, but sometimes just industry people that are there like taking notes on you. And so it's like you're just very uncomfortable. And then like you want so desperately for people to be like, you're in they have these after parties in Montreal, you know.
Oh, they make me so uncomfortable, by the way.
Of course, they make me uncomfortable now. But at the time I was just like a little hedgehog. Like darting around, like is anybody making eye contact? Does anybody want to talk to me? You know, it's like
I hate that feeling, and I get that so much. People would think that I'm very comfortable around other people. I'm actually very like those moments that going to those things make me so uncomfortable.
Oh, they're the worst. But like I was saying, like when you're a new comic, it's the only time in your life where you care more about getting like old Jewish men's phone numbers than hot women. You know what I mean? There could be like a hot woman like, hey, I thought you were getting, you're like, oh, okay, just go away, please. I'm talking to Barry Goldfarb over here.
Bobby Slayton. Like, Bobby Slayton called me one time and I got fucking chills. I was like, I'm on the phone with a pimple of comedy.
Yeah. So you get to this weird like, so it's very uncomfortable, and then. So I've been back since, and it's a little bit more comfortable. And then you get to I'm sure, I don't know if you're at this, but it's like, you're kind of like, I'm me. I'm the guy that does this.
I care. I know what you're saying. I care. I cared this last time because I was like, it was my first time to Montreal. I'd never been before. and it was a lot of fun hanging out, but I was like, man, what if, like, I don't know, like, I was just nervous.
Well, this,
like,
was your first time in Montreal.
First time
this year.
Ever, yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And, you know, you're different because you're established. So imagine you're feeling this year of, like, I want to feel like I'm legit here. And you already know you're legit. Imagine you don't have any evidence suggesting that you're legit. This is the first legitimizing factor that's ever happened to you, is these people going, you know, like, because the last big thing that had happened to me, the last new, you have to go way back, which is I got when I was, like, maybe 2 years into comedy, I auditioned for Jamie Foxx's Laugh-A-Palooza.
And, really?
Yeah.
I remember Jamie Foxx's Laugh-A-Palooza.
Yeah, so, you know, when you were in San Francisco, that's what I mean, I'm in the middle of Alton Club, because when you're in San Francisco, back then especially, in order to get up every night, I think things have changed. In order to get up every night, you had to do White Room Monday, Black Room Tuesday, White Room Wednesday, Black Room Thursday.
It's the greatest. It's the greatest strength a comic can have, but it's a strength that, like, it's like your biceps. Not that I don't know if you're gonna really
I know
get
what
this,
a bicep is,
but okay. But like biceps
fucking,
are like,
you know what, dude. It's because I'm Jewish. Don't, I know what a bicep is.
It's let's
I'm
rephrase
a medical
that.
Doctor because I'm Jewish. So at least I know that.
Doing black clubs is like working out your chest, shoulders, and arms.
Right.
But the problem is, you're going to neglect your legs.
Uh-huh.
So there are guys who've done too many black rooms, and then now their legs look skinny and they look uneven at the beach.
Right.
But doing them really does it.
Absolutely. I don't know. I wonder now if I could do well at a black club. I kind of don't think I could. I know I could do crowd work at a black club.
You wouldn't pander as much.
I wouldn't, and it might not be as successful. But at the time, I did know how to kill in a black room. And
what a muscle, huh?
Yeah, a muscle that's definitely atrophied at this point. I mean, like I said, I think I could do crowd work. I'm very, but I don't know if my jokes. I have no idea. But and it's different. I'm not saying I couldn't make a black audience member happy. I know for sure that's happened. When there's a mixed crowd and there's a bunch of black people, they'll love me. But a black room is a whole different thing.
Yes.
It's like a whole, you're entering into a cultural agreement where it's it's just a completely different, you know.
Yeah. No, I like what you're saying though, because I think some people don't understand quite honestly the fact that you go up. I remember I did Mo Better Mondays.
Uh-huh.
And even D. Ray, who I knew, kind of dismissed me a tad bit. And he was like, but not as a dick, but just as like, this is our room. What the fuck are you doing here?
Right.
And then you got up and I opened up with a Duran Duran joke. Big mistake.
Oh, yeah. I could have talked you through that. Don't do it. I'm running to the stage. No, Bert, no.
Duran Duran. Is he related to Bruce Bruce? So
you want to hear about Bruce Bruce. This is a great black room story. Again, early on in my career, Bruce, there's a room called Pepper Bellies. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, I know Pepper Bellies.
Pepper Bellies has since burned down, people suspect, for nefarious reasons. I don't. And just legally, I don't. And also, before that, a man was murdered there. So just to give you some context of what Pepper Bellies was all about. But they would give you $40 if you would drive 45 minutes to go open for somebody. So I was thrilled at the prospect because Bruce wanted a white opener. And so I'm just like, I'm in, definitely. So I drive out. And so Bruce's crowd, Bruce is very funny. But his crowd is like older, conservative, churchy kind of black people.
Okay? Yeah.
And so his middle act, I go on and I do medium to bad every night. You know, sometimes okay, sometimes truly. And they don't want to see me.
Yeah.
Which is probably why they wanted a white opener.
You are the sorbet.
That's right. I'm the bitter sorbet for them. But his middle act is a guy named Black Boy. That's literally his stage name. And so I get up, I do like a, you know, from 0 to 4 out of 10.
Is he black?
Yeah, he's black.
Okay, because it would be really funny if he was white.
Yeah. Then it's my job to go, okay, well, that was my time that you hardly enjoyed. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, coming to the stage now, it's Black Boy. And he just could feel.
Oh, shut up.
You could feel the audience, like, everyone, like, what? What? What did he just say? And I would just, like, put my head down.
Did you try to hip-hop it up, Black Boy?
No, Black Boy. No, I would just fucking say it and just go, like, hopefully this will work out, and leave the stage. And Black Boy would come on. I just thought, what a crazy name. If you're in the entertainment industry, you are guaranteeing you will never make it in the mainstream entertainment. You're just guaranteed. No one will ever give a development deal to Black Boy. You know what I mean? I mean, I felt like I was like, ladies and gentlemen, your next performer, it's Watermelon Chicken Man. Okay, good night, everybody. It's just like so uncomfortable. He was funny too because he would, every night, if I did well, he would go, hey, give it up for that white boy. That white boy's funny, huh?
Yeah.
And if I didn't, every night, it's like he didn't know me. He would go up and he'd be like, ooh, that white boy stunk or whatever. Like, and I was just like, dude, it's me. We've already, it's me. I've been working with you for 3 days. Yeah. Like, come on.
That white boy's stunk.
He would just talk shit if I did poorly. Anyway, it was such a strange thing.
I worked with a guy named, I'm maybe making this up. I'm almost certain we worked together. His name's Damn Fool.
Oh, Damn Fool. Yeah, sure. Damn Fool.
I remember talking to him. I was like, I didn't know what to call him in the green room. Right. I was like, do I call you Damn? Or like, I can't say Damn Fool every time I'm trying to talk to you.
Mr. Fool?
Yeah, Mr. Fool. He like told me his name. And I was like, how come you chose Damn Fool? Like, because he's funny as fuck.
Right.
He's actually really talented. But I go, and he was really crossover. Like, it wasn't that he was... And I kept saying to him, you're funny in the same way that Dave Chappelle's funny, but imagine if Dave Chappelle had been called Damn Fool.
Yeah,
like,
man.
Dave Chappelle can cross over. It's really hard for a white audience to accept Damn Fool. It's hard to sell tickets to a white audience as Damn Fool, because white people see that on the poster that says Damn Fool, and I'm sure it's like BET, all the credits, BET's whatever, and then Russell Simmons, and then they're going to go, oh, that's a black show. I don't want to go there because I don't want to be the only white guy.
Yep.
So, but he's doing very well.
What
so
did
it's,
he say? Did he just put his head in his hands and shake his head and say, I'm a damn fool?
That's my real name. It's spelled. So, but yeah, working at black clubs is a really
totally.
It's a good muscle to have. Now, where do you work? Do you do the road a lot now?
I do the road, a ton.
Really?
Wait. I never finished. I've never.
Bruce.
Finished.
Bruce.
Oh, I never finished any of the answering any of the questions you asked. My point was the last thing I'd done was I'd done New Faces for Laugh-A-Palooza.
Holy shit!
Which
yeah,
I thought was going to be the biggest thing in my life. Just the worst. I could tell. It's a long story, which I could tell, but whatever. I'll get to your final question. To go to Montreal. Having done New Faces, felt all that anxiety, come out of it the other end feeling successful, like it was a good run, going back to Montreal and done like a regular run, and then finally, this was my third or fourth time there, that I did an hour run every single night of the festival. I was there when I arrived. It was me, Godfrey, and Maria Bamford.
Godfrey, and Maria Bamford.
That was the whole festival, and then the festival, like, you know. That was the only people that were there for the festival were us. And I think the Nasty Show was there too. So to do like a 2-week run, I did 11 or 12 days, 12 shows, an hour on my own. And, you know, that's where you feel comfortable. At a certain point, it's very funny. You know, you get to the point where like you start, you're like, oh, 7-minute sets. That's what I'm all about. I'm all about the 7-minute sets so people could know who I am. And then eventually become like a real, like, sort of, you calm down and settle into your voice and into your body. So an hour is like much more comfortable for me than a 7-minute set an industry showcase. So that was great. You know, to just go do my thing. People came to see me and sold out, I think, 12 shows or something. It was just, it was really cool.
Well, now, I bought your book. The title I'm never going to remember the name of.
It's Casher in the Rye.
Oh, no. I'm sorry, but I knew that part.
The true tale of a white boy from Oakland who became a drug addict, criminal mental patient, and then turned 16.
So fucking fascinating. It was the one book that I literally, I want to say that you tweeted it, and I saw it, and the title fucking grabbed me, and I just went right away and bought it. And I tweeted out, and I started reading it, and it was like, and I just got genuinely overwhelmed at all the shit that has happened in your life.
Yeah,
before now, even before, by the age of 4, I think you have a book worth of life.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I had a strange life for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's so funny because I was on my way over here listening to this This American Life this week about this kid that was like, he was in a Romanian orphanage until he was 7 and a half, and he never laid down. He slept sitting up because he was double in a crib, and he never was picked up by anyone. And then it made me think, like, you know, no matter what your weird life is, like, there's always some dude in Romania who's, like, way worse. You know what I mean? And vice versa. Like, no matter how bad your shit is, there's always how good your shit is, there's somebody that's... So you just have to kind of, like...
I had that conversation with my wife today. Our dog's going back. Our dog had so many fucking problems. Mm-hmm. Torn ACL, now dislocated kneecap.
Jesus.
And I was like, you know what? There's someone dealing with more shit than us.
Totally.
Like, but I will say... You're kind of at a high water mark. I mean,
it was definitely crazy for sure. My life was very strange.
Have you talked about it a lot? About your life?
Yeah.
In promoting the book, did it get to a place where you felt disconnected?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked because I don't want to feel like a jerk. I'm down to talk about it.
No, you know what? I'm tired. Like, I am in the same boat you are, where I feel like I've done this soft shoe of who I am to people so much
that
it doesn't even feel real anymore.
Yeah, and especially when you're talking about, like, you know, the, like, deep emotional realities, it's like you don't want to get to the point where you feel like, yeah, so right, it did get pretty crazy. I mean, my parents are deaf, and then I was in mental institutions, and, you know, it's like you don't want to feel – that shouldn't feel rote to you, you know?
God damn it, man.
But it is. At a certain point, people ask you the same question enough times, like, you go, yeah. Yeah, that was crazy.
Especially when you write a book about it, and then that becomes, you get on the phone with your marketing team.
Totally.
And they kind of soft shoe around it, and they're like, so how comfortable are you?
Right.
We'd love to have you do some deaf interviews. It would be great to promote the book.
Right.
And you're like...
And you got to do what you got to do to promote the book. And
yeah.
Then on the other end of that, having done all the promotion for the book, yeah, it's sort of like, I felt like, God, I never want to talk about this book again. Which is too bad because it's some thing I'm the most proud of that I've done. I mean, more than any of
you are a really great writer. You and Patton Oswalt are the only. I'm not saying I haven't read Mark's book, but I have it. I haven't read it, but you and Patton Oswalt are the two people that I've read that are comics that I was like, oh, they could have been other stuff too.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. I did that. I tried very hard to make sure that the book stood on its own legs literarily. That it was, because I was like a lot. I went to these, and I won't name names, but I went to these publishers, and they would all give me the book of the people that they had published, the comedians that they had published.
So funny, yeah.
And so I would read a lot of these books. Were like, some of them were like, they were fun, but they were coffee table books. And some of them, you could tell one in particular, which I won't name, you could tell it was like a guy who'd gotten a book contract and then like went like, fuck, all right. You know, I gotta do something here. So then each chapter was disjointed and like it was, it'd be like stand up notes and like just complete, like, you know.
So Dimitri Martin?
It wasn't.
I got Dimitri's book from someone.
Dimitri's book, I didn't read the whole thing, but it did say what you will about whether you liked it or not. It did have a thing that it was doing.
Yeah.
You know what I
mean? It's Dimitri. It's the way his brain works.
Exactly. It felt like a Dimitri Martin book. Even if there's some parts that are very weird and kind of experimental. Well, that's what he's going to do.
Yeah.
No, but I'm talking about a different book where it was like, there was a chapter in there. I mean, I feel bad, but there was a chapter in there where this person just, I don't know if I should say it because it'll be so identifiable, but he just described the rules of a party game. And it was a whole chapter in his book. He's like, how to play this party game. And I was just like, dude, come on. You know that he was just like, fuck, I got to fill like 20 pages here now. What am I going to do? It was an established party game. It's not like he made the game up.
Yeah.
It was like as if I was like, how to play, you know, war, how to play cards, you know. It's like, oh, and then you put a little funny thing. So I was very concerned with making sure that it read well, that it wouldn't be, I call them like take a shit books.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you go and take a shit and you're like,
oh, yeah.
Thumb through and you go, okay, I'm done. I wanted to make a real book, and that I feel like I accomplished.
You definitely did. You definitely did. And it was the, like, I read your book. I've been reading comics books for a while.
Have you done a book?
I'm just finished it.
Oh, cool.
It comes out May 27th, I want to say.
Yeah?
I'll tell you right now. It comes out June, July. It comes out, fuck, that's June. It comes out May 27th.
Cool. Who's doing it?
St. Martin.
All right, cool.
And so I have an alarm set that'll tell us when it's time for us to leave.
Cool.
Because I got to pick up my daughter at... Oh, we have fun. But you tell me when you got
to
leave, too.
I don't have to leave till 1:30. So
okay, perfect. 1:22 is when I have to leave.
Cool.
But yeah, I was like... There was the option of getting a ghostwriter.
Oh, right.
And they were like, you know, a lot of people do it. And then they told me the people that done it, and a couple of them One of them was a friend I had
name
had
names. No, I'm just kidding.
I was so close. One was a friend of mine who lied to me and said he wrote his book.
Whoa, no shit.
And he lied to me, and I was like, because I knew
well,
it's this.
Embarrassing. Well, on the yeah. one hand, that's fucked up. On the other hand, it's kind of like, I'd be embarrassed.
What's
say.
Crazy is that at the time he was writing his book, he bought a computer, and he had a hard time figuring out how to turn his computer on. And I remember him going like, yeah, it's a brand new computer. Like, I'm sure there's an on. Like, and I was like, but I actually believed he wrote his book. I actually believed it.
Right.
And then they told me, and they're like, no, he didn't write his book. Like, wow. we did both his books, and he didn't write either of them. And I went, are you fucking shitting me? And I was like, and then when I said to myself, I'm gonna write my fucking book. I'm gonna sit in my room. And at the time, Greg Fitzsimmons, who I bought his book too, Greg Fitzsimmons was talking about using Dragon Dictate, and I was like, "Ooh, I'll try Dragon Dictate." Problem with Dragon Dictate is you can't be a drinker and use it because it doesn't understand a word you fucking say.
I'm hearing Irish folk songs, Irish folk songs.
But yeah, reading your book and yours and Patton's exclusively. I went, oh, these are real fucking writers. And I knew I could write. Like, I knew I was a writer. And I thought that's where I'd end up being had I not gotten into comedy.
Right. Well, that's sort of my thing is when I was young, if you had asked me, do you want to be a stand-up comic, I would have never, it never occurred to me in my life until I got on stage.
Yeah.
But if you'd asked me if I wanted to be a writer, that was sort of always what I thought when I was a kid. Oh, I think I'll be a writer. I want to write books. You know, that was my... That made sense.
I wanted it to be as accessible, like you and Patton have beautiful prose. The way you guys write really kind of jumps. It really kind of belongs on the page. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be as accessible as like David Sedaris,
right,
and Ernest Hemingway. If that makes sense,
sure.
Like because that's how I do stand up.
Well,
and
it
I
sort
was
of
like,
sounds like you know, I mean that's a, sort of who you are as a comic. You're like a man,
yeah.
A, you know, man,
yeah.
I mean, I'm in your man cave. There's fucking rusty saws on the wall, and you know,
I got a fucking machete right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, dude, this is a man's area, but also you're a comic, so it's funny and it's clever. So that is, I see that sort of coming together.
Right? No, what do you ever feel like so your book comes out, you're literally, I would say, what do you get like top 10 comics of the year? You're not a guy that doesn't get accolades.
Yeah,
accolades
sure.
Like they're well deserved. But do you ever get to a place where you're like I accomplished my dreams. Now what's next?
Well, that's funny that you. I mean, I don't feel like I get all of the accolades.
No, you don't get all the accolades.
There certainly are those comics that get all of the accolades. You won't ever see a top 10 list without them being on it. I don't consider myself one of them, but. But I do.
You're respected by the people that respect people.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do feel like I remember I had this thought once where I go, because I have an anxiety sometimes, you know, about my life and my career, and I was going, well, what would you want to be doing if you could do anything? And I thought, well, I'd like to be like touring, and writing books, and making a living doing comedy. And then I just thought like, oh, that's actually what's currently occurring.
Yeah.
So I just, it's all about fear and neurosis. Like, so my dream, you know, the older I get, the more I think all I want to do, because I've been thinking a lot about this lately, like no matter what I do, I'm not going to be, even if I become Dave Chappelle, and I'm going to go ahead and say, I'm probably not going to become Dave Chappelle. Maybe I will. But you know what I'm saying? Even if I become the top, the apex predator of stand-up comedy, even if I do that, no one's going to remember me in 50 years. No one's going to remember Louis C.K. in 50 years. He'll just be a fucking thumb, a page on the, you know what I mean? It's like maybe in 50 years people go, yeah, Louis C.K., there was a very, very, he was a very funny comic in the 2000s. That's and then in 100 years... Nothing. No one's going to remember Phyllis Diller in 100 years. Like, you know, people will remember maybe Pryor in 100 years from now.
Carlin.
Carlin. I bet Carlin will be gone. And the point is, there's no point to desperately like going like, oh, I got to get to the top so the people know me or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, oh. So my only real desire right now is to make stuff that feels like satisfying to me personally. Make a living doing comedy and continue to like make cool stuff. Like the one thing I do am obsessed with is I want to do stuff that my peers aren't doing. I want to, not that I want to be better than my peers. I just want to do stuff that like they're not doing. So like, you know, I felt like my book, even though I felt a lot of people are writing books, like I felt like, well, I want to write a real memoir. Like
yours was it was very different than any of the comics books I read.
Yeah, and I
Patton's was yours and Patton's in my, and I keep using Patton's because
I haven't Patton's, read Patton's actually.
Werewolves and Lollipops, I think, yeah, is the name of it. I read Patton's and I went, and that was the first book I read that I went, oh shit, like that really. And yours was in that same vein of like, this is real writing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and I think you accomplished that.
Obviously my story was weird, so it made it easier. But I was like, I wanted to make sure the writing was there. And then now, like, I sold the book to Showtime to make a show. And so now I'm like, cool, what I want to do right now is I want to make like a real, like, drama filled, like a real, I mean, I don't want to say dramedy because it's such the worst word, but I want to make like a half hour dark serious comedy.
Yeah.
And I feel like of my peers in stand-up, nobody's doing that. Like,
yeah.
No one, you know, Lena Dunham, I don't know her or consider her a peer.
Jeff,
Jeff Dunham. Jeff Dunham's definitely doing a serious dramedy, but he doesn't know it. No.
Wait, what's Lena Dunham's?
Girls.
Fat Girls?
Girl.
No, oh my God, I can't believe I just said that.
I can't either. But you said it.
Shit.
I didn't.
I just got in so much trouble for saying Fat Girls at UCB.
You can edit this out. But
no.
But
leave it. It's the fuck. I can't believe I just. You know why I said that? Because Pete Holmes and I got into an argument of whether or not you could use the term fat girls,
uh-huh.
And he had the girl from Girls on his TV show,
yeah.
and the girl that leads it is a tad bit.
Sure.
Not overweight, but maybe.
Hey,
maybe you just showed back up, and I did edit that out. Who fucking knows?
So we're back.
You were saying Lena Dunham, Jeff's sister, is doing a great.
Well, she. I'm not saying she's doing. She's doing a half-hour sort of dramedy, but she's not a stand-up. I don't know of any stand... Like, I feel like all the stand-ups I know, all the people that I'm peers with are either doing... They're doing late-night talk show situations, yeah. Late-night panel show situations, or sketch shows, or, like, silly sitcoms. Like, so you got, like, you've got your Chelsea Lately's, your Jimmy Fallon's, your, you know... Chappelle shows or your Saturday Night Lives or your Workaholics. Like, I sort of feel like mm-hmm. a lot of the people that I do are making a version of those shows.
Yeah.
Their own version, and they're awesome.
Yeah.
But I wanted to do something that wasn't like any of that. So that's my goal. What I am passionate about is continuing to do stuff that means something to me and continue to do stuff that is sort of different than what my peers are doing.
I was like that when I was younger.
Yeah.
I'm not...
By the way, that's weird that you even say that because what you're doing is like so outside the box of what most stand-ups do.
What's that?
Your Travel Channel thing.
Oh yeah.
But
oh yeah.
It's not like every comic I know is traveling around the world doing like a.
I'll tell you what. I'm gonna long wind this answer. God damn it! I need to do a podcast where my mic only works for 15 minutes because I end up talking over people and not letting them
just
be on.
Have
my
me show. On. I talk a lot, so
dude. I'll have you on again. By the way, I could talk to you for fucking 2 hours.
Yeah, for sure.
To go back to you having deaf parents and going into a mental institution, you felt like you oversold it. I feel like when I sold my book, I felt like. I wrote all my great stories in there, and I've told all my great stories on podcasts, and I've got
right.
And I feel like I'm done.
I know what
I'm
you mean.
Fucking done, and I don't have any more stories. I haven't done. Look, I did a lot. I robbed a train. I fucking did PCP. Like, there's, I did it a lot of shit. But I'm like, I'm done. So, but the thing that I hang my hat on is that Travel Channel has allowed me the opportunity to really live an adventure every month.
Right.
Like a full-blown fucking adventure.
And
like
how many bits have you gotten out of the Travel Channel?
So fucking many.
That is so like, lucky.
I run the risk of just talking about my TV show all the time. So I still try to write comedy. You know, comedy is for me is something that I don't really it just shows up. It just shows up and then I'm like, "Ooh, that it's
I'm the
there."
Same way. Yeah.
So but
I wish I wasn't, man.
But I used to tell people when I wish I wasn't too. I wish I could fucking sit and just jot down notes.
Yeah,
Dimitri Martin comes to mind right when he said that.
Absolutely,
he wakes up every fucking morning and works for an hour and then like 10 minutes allotted to writing, making a new game. 10 minutes allotted to inventions for ties. Like he's really compartmentalized in that
way.
On
the other hand, Dimitri Martin has been doing comedy how long?
As long 15, as me, 15 as long years. As
you, great.
14 years.
How much do you know about Dimitri Martin? Not that this is superior or inferior.
I know a lot.
Well, no, you. But I'm saying you, the viewer,
yes.
We get to know almost nothing about that person, right? Mm-hmm. There are certain people who are, you know, they write like that. I mean, Stephen Wright, too, you know?
Yeah.
You don't know anything about Stephen Wright, you know? But, like, people like us, like, who write based on our own, the experiences that happen to us, well, then the audience kind of actually has a understanding. Not that, I don't think it's better or worse.
Too much sometimes.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like I've...
Podcast.
Dude, I'm an open book. I mean, I go to shows now and people are like, tell about Isla and the tree.
Right.
The tree I just took out. But yeah. Like, you get into this really, like, I had to go to therapy for it.
Really?
Yeah, when I stepped on stage, I remember thinking, the first time I was thinking, I don't want there to be a separation from who I am on stage and off stage. Like,
yeah.
You'd see someone like Dane Cook, mm-hmm. and you'd be like, he must be fun to get high with.
Right.
Doesn't smoke weed, doesn't right. drink, never, none, you really, really enjoy caffeine.
Right.
And you're like, what?
Totally.
And then, and I'm not saying that I felt that it was a lie, but I felt that I'd been misled.
Uh-huh.
Like Daniel Tosh. Totally oh. thought stoner.
Yeah, right.
You just read it, and it helps tell the story when you see that guy, and you're like stoner, hardcore stoner, maybe a little coke on Friday nights,
right?
And so I was like, I want to make sure that I stay who I am on stage and off stage because that's who I am. It's an extension of who I am.
Jeselnik too. Jeselnik's very nice.
Yeah, like, yeah, you know, disarmingly
he's
nice.
He's a friendly, polite person.
It's so funny. Like he like write a mean tweet, and yeah. you just go, I know that he's not joking. Like
right,
but And so it crept into my life, and I think these personas that I've developed, by the way, who I developed, like the machine thing that I that was a part of who I was,
mm-hmm.
and it still is in a weird way. And so when people like want to take a shot, I take a shot with them, you know,
right.
like, and so it definitely. But to make a very long story short, when I first started watching stand-up, I'd hear people go, "I'm a storyteller," but they didn't really tell stories; they mm-hmm. just would not tell jokes. They tell a little longer jokes.
Right.
I was like, I want to be a storyteller. Yeah. I want to be like straight up the guy that could go into a fucking preschool and tell a story to kids.
Yeah.
But then be careful what you wish for.
It's also weird because like I consider myself sort of a storytelling comic too. My bits mm-hmm. are very long. I mean, they're 10 minutes plus and I love it. I wouldn't want to be a different kind of comedian. I almost feel like if I was a guy telling Dimitri-esque jokes, it feels to me just like, oh, I'm just telling jokes. Like, what's the point? And yet, what I enjoy watching, I mean, I like storytelling comics, but like yeah. what I enjoy watching, I enjoy like, you know, Zach Galifianakis and
yeah.
Brent Weinbach and like real weird people. That's who I like watching. So it's kind of like weird. It's like, but I never write that way.
I don't write that way, but that's who I love watching too.
Yeah.
I like watching Attell.
Yeah. Well,
like setup punch.
yeah.
I like Norton. He's kind of experimenting, I think, in more of a storytelling way.
Norton to me is the guy who should be like thought of in that Bill Burr, Louis C.K. sort of, not that he's not respected, he is, but like he's like the great, like the sort of unknown, not that he's unknown, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I think Norton's like fantastic.
You think he is under-respected by yes. fans.
Yes, that's right. By comedy fans. Like,
yeah.
People don't mention him when they go like their rundown, and they should, basically. And it's very simple why. What he's talking about is horrifying. You know, it's offensive. But it's so good.
It's so precious.
Yeah, and
because he's being honest about something that no one would be honest. Like,
right.
I felt like I think, like, I don't know when I talked to him. But I talked to him about like some pretty honest shit
mm-hmm.
one time. I was like, that's so weird to be that guy, to be the guy that you put your shit out there, and so now people feel safe going to you and being like, hey, man, when
right.
you talk about sex addiction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, people must constantly. And Stanhope, I guess, is another guy that's just like so brilliant.
Stanhope is I would say he should get like one of those
Humanitas or Mark Twain.
No, yeah, no. What's the one where they give a guy $150,000 a year to not do anything but his art?
Oh, yeah.
A McGovern grant,
right? I think I know what you're saying, right?
God,
but yeah, no, he's so good.
Yeah,
but whatever. I mean, hey,
we could blow smoke up everyone's ass.
Yeah, totally. Let's talk about people that are
hate.
Bad.
Yeah.
there we go.
Oh, there's I listened to you guys. I listened to the champs.
Oh, cool, man!
And I listened to the episode with
shit.
You can name content. I'll
Jody High Roller.
Oh, Riff Raff.
Riff Raff.
Brother. Yeah. A rough one.
That was a really, it was only a great podcast because it was so hard to listen to.
You want to talk about persona getting in your way. That's a great example. It's like,
yeah?
Rap must be on a whole other level of persona because, you know, at least you are allowed to say, nah, it's just me on stage. You know, I'm just a comic. But you're a rapper. Your whole thing is predicated on the fact that you're keeping it real.
Yeah.
So you can't, 90% of rappers are fake or are doing a theater performance. But you cannot say,
literally
I'm
doing
fake.
A theater performance.
Yeah, you can't be like, oh, I'm fake. You know, I'm not shit. You know, then you're just people are like, oh, we're done.
Rick Ross.
Right. So many, almost everybody.
He was a correctional officer.
Right. Right. Yeah. But Jody High Roller is so lost in his persona. I'm not sure that he doesn't. It might be real at this point. It's like a weird. People go, is he faking it or is it real? And I go, yeah. You know, both. You know, it's just like, I couldn't get him to answer a single question. It was all just like, and at a certain point, it's like, we're comics, man. Like, you're not going to, Neil said it. He's like, we're too smart for this. Like, you know, you're doing a thing which is going to work for dumb people, but like, come on.
Yeah.
So I would be like, what did you listen to growing up? And he would be like, man, what's growing up? You know what I mean? I came up, I didn't grow up. You know, and it's just like, okay, dude, we'll be right back.
The best part was that DJ Doug Pound.
Yeah.
It keeps jumping in when I don't think he knows what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, wait, where's that coming from?
Yeah. Oh, his little drops and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was a very rough. Also, Jody was white. You know, Riff Raff's white.
Yeah.
So we felt bad about that. You know, the champs, too.
The champs only has we only black guests.
Black and then black adjacent. You know, we've had some Mexicans on. We've had a couple Pakistani and an Indian, but a Korean, little Bobby Lee's been on. We try very hard never to have white people on.
I don't blame you.
I mean, you know.
You know what? But here's the thing is, no one's more qualified than you, and I'd say
Neil by
default. I mean,
no, I would say Neil maybe primarily. I mean, look, we're not really trying to get qualification. The truth is, like, what our idea was like, what if we did a podcast where, you know, it would be people, all people of color, and because our idea was like podcasting is so white,
yeah,
it's like every camp. You know, the people are in. It's still just like a group of white people that go from podcast to podcast interviewing each other.
Yeah.
So we were like, what if, you know, if it's all black dudes, then, like, you know, almost everybody we got on with, it would be their first podcast. And it's true. I would say 75% of people that we have on our show have never done a podcast before.
Really?
And, you know, we've had like really cool, interesting people on. Robert Townsend and Blake Griffin and Too Short came on. Like, you know, Wayne Brady. Like a lot of people who had never done podcasts before. I just thought it's been really cool, actually.
That's fucking fascinating. I saw the list. I did research for my buddy Mark, who was just here, because I was like, I never do research.
Yeah, sure.
And then I was laying in bed this morning, and I was like, there's so much I'd want to talk to you about. And I was like, well, I should take a look at his Wikipedia. Uh-huh. And I saw who you guys have had on in the champs, and I forget what name popped out, but I was like, shut the fuck up.
Well, it's been interesting, you know, it's like we've had a lot of really big people on, you know, John Legend and Praz from the Fugees and of course, Riff Raff, Baron Davis we had on. We've had all kinds of...
Baron Davis is an interesting dude.
Well, he had an interesting episode of The Champs, you know.
Really?
He was like talking for like an hour about some very regular, serious shit. You know, helping the children, whatever. And then all of a sudden we started talking about this freeway. I don't know how it got brought up. The freeway between Vegas and Los Angeles. And he goes, oh, yeah, I was abducted by aliens on that freeway. And we were just like, what? take again? And then he just doubled down on it. He was like, yeah. You know, I was like driving and then I kind of flashed out. And I woke up like 40 miles later and I pulled off and I got in it. And we were just like, I was like, are you like joking? He never revealed that. Like, he never... said, yes, I'm joking. So whatever, it was crazy because we were just like, damn, you were just so serious and sober for like an hour and then all of a sudden you were talking about aliens. We thought nothing of it. The next day or 2 days later after we released it, it got picked up by this little sports blog which sent it to like Yahoo Sports, which sent it to, all of a sudden it was just like everywhere. It was on the front page of the New York Post. Like, you know, Baron Davis. That's the pulpy one, right? The Post?
Yeah.
Right, so it's like, Baron Davis, I've been abducted by aliens. There's like a UFO above him as he's dunking. And he, I mean, it was just like, became a national sports news story. And that was kind of the coolest thing that's happened. I mean, it was bad for him. He was just like, what the fuck did I just do? But, hey, man.
No, the one thing I know about brothers is, I'm not going to say all, never say all, but all my black friends have run trains on girls.
Oh, really?
Oh, I remember. The point. I'm not going to say names, but it got to the point where I was sitting with three black men, and they were shocked that I had never run a train on a girl.
Ah, that's interesting. That's a stereotype I've not heard about yet.
Seriously?
Yeah. No, I didn't know. I mean, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But I hadn't heard about that. Yeah, because we talk about stereotypes a lot on the podcast.
Bring it up, and then just give me like a little side credit.
Oh, yeah, I'll definitely bring that one out. I'll shout you out. You know, like so far we've talked about like conspiracy theories. Like a lot of black dudes believe in conspiracy theories. Washing with a washcloth. That's more of a stereotype about white people. The white people don't wash with a washcloth.
Oh, I don't. Yeah, I never use a washcloth.
We just scrub with our hands.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do more stereotypes because there are things like all black men mm-hmm. know how to make fucking great omelets.
Is that right?
Yep.
I don't know about this.
I was taught how to make omelets twice in my life.
I like this.
Twice. Patrice O'Neal, Donnell Rollins.
But you can't...
Black men always season the pan and not the omelet.
This is very interesting. But your sample population is a bit small. Donnell and Patrice, I don't feel like...
grew up in Boston, one grew up in Maryland. That's reaching half that coast.
You're like the world's worst scientist.
They always...
with an exhaustive research study of Ashy Larry and from the guy from The Office. No, you need more. I feel like this is plenty. This will suffice.
Black men always... I say men because I don't really know. I have the only... Like, I've never had... Black women have a power over white men that... I think makes most white men uncomfortable.
It's interesting.
I believe. These are all my, by the way, these are all
no, your race theories. Sure.
My race theories is that black women just have a power over me. Let me just rephrase that. Why am I saying fucking white men?
Sure.
Black women have a power over me. And so I never really like.
What do you mean by that?
I mean.
What power? Like you find them sexy, you find them scary. What do you?
No, I think sexy.
Sexy.
Like it's a confident energy.
Yeah.
That they, like. I got into a very long conversation with Samora one time.
Sure.
And
we almost had her on, then she disappeared, literally.
Really?
She was like, I'd love to do it. It was at Montreal this year.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm so thrilled, I'd love to. And we were like, great, how about four? Four is great. And then all of a sudden, she just like, we started texting her. She's like, no response. And then her manager was like, Samora will be unable to. You motherfucker, we just talked to you a half hour ago. Anyway.
Like, I'll put it this way. I hooked up with one black chick once.
Yeah.
And then she cuddled me.
She spooned you?
She spooned me. In my bed. It was my bed.
Come here, baby. She pulls you over to her.
Like maybe it's a sexual energy. I don't know. But like black men I can always connect to really quickly. Mm-hmm. I always have like a, I feel like a brotherhood. I don't know. Like Warren Sapp and I hung out one night.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's
Warren
cool.
Sapp should do your podcast.
I would love that.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's got some great fucking stories.
I bet.
But I connect really quickly with black men, I think, sometimes. Black women, I always feel like I end up listening a lot.
You feel intimidated. You know, it's interesting. It's like, because I grew up in a black situation. You know, like I grew up in Oakland, you know, public school system. So everybody was black around me all the time. So my relationship with black culture, like for a long time when I was young, was based on like fear and worship. You know what I mean? Like I was sort of afraid and uncomfortable because like, you know, the truth is like, you know, I would get... You know, when I was real young, I'd get, you know, jumped. Or if there was like a big group of black teenagers walking towards me, like in Oakland, it was just like, let's see how this goes. And then worship, because I was in a social environment where black kids were the top of the food chain, you know, by far. You know, I say in the book, like, you know, what would be a letter, the high school quarterback, you know, blonde Chip or whatever, wearing a Letterman jacket, was like a black gangster. That was like the top sort of social thing that you could be. It's like, look at the gangster. He's so impressive. And so my stuff is all, I was talking the other day, speaking of stereotypes, I was on the podcast talking about, there was a moment where, because a stereotype about white people, and it's probably true, that black people have about us, is that we scream at our mothers. We swear to our mothers.
Oh, yeah.
Or tell our mothers to shut up. Like, that kind of shit is much less common in a black family. And they were, and I was telling this story about, I was at in junior high when I was in the middle of all my trouble. My mom was there. We just had like some behavioral meeting. My mom's screaming at me. We're at my middle school and I'm walking out and I'm just like, fuck you, mom. And I, like, as I said that, or, you know, I turned my head and there's this black girl like a 100 feet away across the quad at my, just like, it's like, you know, that turn into their eye contact. And she's just like, shakes her head all slow-mo. She's like, fucking white boys. I was so ashamed. I was so ashamed. She like reached right into my like world. Fuck. And like, fuck you, mom. No. It was really quite a moment.
I was reading something online last night about Knockout. We were talking about Knockout.
Oh, the game Knockout. Game, sure.
And I was reading something online and it was saying that the media has perpetuated this.
I believe that.
Do you?
100%. I think, I'm not 100% sure if Knockout is real. We were talking about this earlier. Like, I think maybe it's fake or maybe it isn't fake. But now it's not fake. No matter what, if it was fake or it wasn't fake, now everybody's watching it on the news going, oh, the Knockout game? I guess we'll play the Knockout game.
Yeah.
And then people, you know, start to do it. I mean, honestly, what's the Knockout game? People randomly assaulting people? That's not new. That's been happening. That's always been happening.
In Australia, they call it a King's Punch.
Is that right?
It was a really big thing when we were in Australia. Like probably 6 months ago, they said, you know, you got to be careful for the King's Punch. It's really popular right now. They're talking about it on the media.
Whoa.
So I wonder if, and I read this and I go, what's a King's Punch? And it's like a soccer punch. People are soccer punching people, and one kid had died in Australia.
Well, yeah, and then people say that maybe it feels like race baiting, and in a way it does.
It is race baiting.
You know, it's like,
telling white people, if you be afraid of young black men.
Right, be afraid. And then you get into this thing where you go like, yeah, except that if I saw a group of like young white, you know, hip-hop hooligans, I would be just as afraid.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I would be like, oh, these are the same dudes that are, you know.
If I see a group of young Vietnamese kids
who are just who are they?
I don't even need them to look like anything.
Oh, no?
If I see a group of anything walking towards me,
yeah.
But I'm obsessive compulsive and riddled with anxiety.
Uh-huh.
So I look at things 2 steps ahead of everything.
Right.
Dude was working out behind me in the gym at the hotel. I'm on the treadmill. There's no mirror, and he's standing behind me. I had to stop and go, hey, man, you can't be behind me.
What'd he say?
He was like, what? I was like, you can't. Like, I don't know what the fuck you're doing. Like, if you could just be off to the side a little bit so I can see you in my periphery. Because he was like, right behind me.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, you can't. But by the way, and I'm putting it in perspective. Say the room's this big, big as this right here. And there's 3 treadmills here and all the weights are over here. He's behind my treadmill working out. And I go, you can't do that, man.
Yeah.
And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, I'm here. You need to be over there. That's how this works. Because my brain is like 3 steps ahead. I always see him
clanging that barbell on your head.
Killing me. And I'm fucking in a hotel. And then it was a heart attack. He drinks a lot. So
what did he say? Did he do it?
Yeah, he did it. Yeah, he did it.
I would have just left if I was him. I'd be so embarrassed.
I was pretty cool about it. I'm very bad with confrontation.
Yeah.
So when I confront somebody about anything, it's so apologetic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's so over the top. Like, but I read that and I was like, you know what? They are. If I believe Chris Rock is right in saying the media is not racist when he said that, but I do believe the media is racist. I do believe that it is white people running the media, and they are predominantly, and they just go, what sells?
Right. Except I think it's like one level beneath that, which is like, yeah, racism is everywhere in the media. I don't think anybody in the media, well, not anybody, obviously, like Ann Coulter is like obviously deciding to go like, what would be, this is terrible. Do people respond?
Yeah.
But like most media, and Fox News to some degree too, but I think most media, they're just writing in the world that they live in. You know, what sells, but not like you were saying, what sells, like we'll do this and it'll be inflammatory and people will buy the paper. But it's more like they just, we're all a product of this system that perpetuates, you know, racism and perpetuates classism and poverty. So, I mean, it's also, like I said, if it's a group of young, like, white kids that are obviously all, like, street hooligans, it's the same kind of thing.
I'm afraid of youth.
Youth are scary.
Youth, you know, in general.
Youth are scary.
Yeah.
That's not even, you should be afraid of youth. I mean, think about yourself when you were young, and also think about, you know, things have gotten more sort of detached and violence has gotten more celebrated and a lot of it is hip-hop's fault. You know, I know that's an unpopular, you know, thing to say, but video games, I think it's silly for people to go, video games and hip-hop don't cause anybody to do anything. It's like, you know that they do. We all know that they do. It's okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's just the way that it is. Also, the media and also, you know, corporations, they're all, you know, the devaluing of human life. Everything is connected, but let's stop pretending like, you know, you can listen to a song 1,000 times like kill the cops, and it doesn't affect the way people think about the cops. By the way, I don't like the cops very much, but
you don't.
I don't love them. You do. You seem like a guy that does.
Yeah, they're always call him sir.
They're abusive, not to you, I guess.
Not to me.
Not to me either, honestly.
But you know what's so funny is I had an interaction with a cop at Burbank Airport.
Uh-huh.
I pulled in to pick up my parents, and I parked. They had their stuff. And I pulled into a handicap spot in the parking garage, and they wanted to load, and the cop pulled up right behind me and said, this isn't a loading zone. I'm going to have to give you a ticket. And I went, okay. And he went, no. I mean, this is a $600 ticket. And I said, I understand that. And he goes, no, I'm telling you, you can't just – and he was really had an issue.
Right.
And I was like, I'm so ingrained to respect the police
that
I went, sir, I've clearly broken the law. I did not know that. Is my ignorance, but ignorance is not, it does not, what is it? Ignorance is not defend you against breaking the law.
Uh-huh.
So
I don't know if that's a saying, but
it's something like that.
It sounds right.
And so I said, I apologize and I deserve the ticket and I'll wait until you write it up. And he said, well, if you wait, you can't wait here. I said, well, I'm getting the ticket, sir, I'm going to hang out in the handicap spot while you write it. I'm not going to go park somewhere else so you can write me a ticket for what I did. And he was like, well, you can't just sit here. I'll have to write you another one. And I said, well, then you're forcing me to write. I said, sir, you got to do whatever you got to do. I apologize. In my head, I'm like, I have the money to pay it. It's not a big deal. And he's just was like, just leave. But I think I just killed him with kindness.
Yeah.
But that was a way, you know, raised, especially in the South. Raised in the South, cops sometimes had a chip on their shoulder.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's the real problem with cops is that they're just people. You forget. They're just like people, you know.
Regular.
They're just people, and they have a uniform on. They forget too, by the way. They don't. They stop acting like people. You know. You ever try to like make a little joke in line with a cop? They're like not into it.
Yeah.
Because they're like, I'm not a person. I'm a. You don't joke with me. I'm in this uniform. I'm wearing this outfit. Like,
I've done those jokes before.
Yeah.
The one time, I bet I could get your gun.
Oh, well, that's a great one. I mean, I could have. That's like your Duran Duran joke at the Black Club. The only thing less popular than a Duran Duran joke at a Black Club is a joke about grabbing a cop's gun.
But I can get your gun.
but you know, there's a system. Are we done?
No. I'm just checking to see if we're still recording.
Yeah. I mean, there's a system where they can't not be abusive. That's what I'm saying. It's like, do I think most cops join the force so that they can unfairly pull over and beat up black people? No. But there's a system in place that when they get into that uniform, they get this, you know, power, feeling of power, and then they have like, you know, the arrest laws and the neighborhoods that they're sent to and the things they're taught to look for. So all of a sudden they're just pulling over black guys all the time. And then, you know, 1,000 black guys in, you know, every black guy they've pulled over has been pulled over 1,000 times. So by the time they pulled a black guy over 1,000 times and gotten an attitude 1,000 times because the guy that they're pulling over is inside of a system that's racist pulling them over, then they start going, well, fuck these people. And then everything's downhill, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, by the time you get to your 1,000th pullover, it's just like, shut the fuck up, hands on the deck, and then everybody feels abused and everybody sort of is being abused except the cops are supposed to be better. They're not supposed to be doing anyway.
It should be. There should be some. Well, I mean, the only way to solve it is make all cops millionaires.
Right. That's interesting. Make all cops millionaires. I mean, no, I don't think that would work. I think they would still be like, in the name of justice, I'm pulling
like,
you.
They have the law in New York. They can just search anybody.
Risk. Right.
That's fucking insane.
But you know who gets searched? It's black and Latinos.
Yeah.
90% of the stop and frisk stops have been black and Latinos, which it's an insane law. You've done
it's
nothing.
It's a really crazy law.
It's like literally you look black. That's what you're being pulled over for.
That is insane.
I mean
you can't help but not think that there's, you know, that the, whatever someone may begrudge and go, oh, black people's literally a chip on their shoulder, I'd fucking be irate. I'd be irate. My life experience is so user friendly.
Right.
I mean, I go in and when I have a shorthand I can share with people that I know how to talk to, like, Like if a white cop pulls me over, I'm like, listen, I know my buddy Jack's a cop in Tampa.
Yeah.
I know how to deal with what's going to happen, and then I know when to stop, and I know what, you know.
Right.
So,
it's like this, like the people who say, because that's the thing that like white people like to say. It's some white people, and you know, not only white people. Some people in general, they like to say, you know, get over it.
It's, yeah,
you know, bad things happen, but get over it. And then you go, you know, like you're here now. And then you go, okay, well, what do they mean? I've been thinking about this a lot because I've been trying to write a bit about it. It's kind of complicated to write, but what do they mean when they say get over it? The things happened in the past, but now. So we had slavery. And then that ended in, I don't know, what it was, 1834? Well, I don't have any idea. Something like that.
Oh, 1870.
Civil War was 1870?
I want to say the Emancipation Proclamation was...
1870. Then they immediately, I mean instantly, switched over into segregation. So
yeah.
Then that went all the way up to like 1960, what, five?
Yeah.
So, okay, you got slavery, then you got segregation until 65. Then you had... Sort of, I mean, I'm not going to say it was perfectly good. There was, you know, poverty, and there was, you know, you had the 70s. People were chilling out,
yep.
Bell bottoms, Shaft, what's up? And then in the 80s started the war on drugs, where they just were like transferring basically segregation and slavery. They put both of them into our prison system. So
yeah.
They go, oh, well, I mean, we can't legally. Oh, I got it. We'll just start, you know, basically shipping people off to prison to warehouse them. There are more people in prison. My girlfriend told me this the other day. There are more people in prison. There are more black men in prison today than were ever enslaved in this country. So it's like, well, when were they supposed to get over it? During the 70s?
I mean, yeah.
It was just the 70s. That was their time to get over it. It was like
yeah.
10, you know, 63 to like 81. Or like, hurry, we got to get over it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but they were busy, you know, dancing to disco and wearing bell bottoms.
Fucking Soul Train.
Yeah, man. They were dancing.
Yeah.
They were trying to get over it. We didn't give them enough time.
It was the afterglow of the 70s was all the... There was still racism,
right,
but...
Like I said, you know, it's a flawed premise anyway.
No.
The 70s were great. But the point is there. It's like, get over it. There is no... That's such a white place of white privilege. And I'm not a guy that's like, white privilege, blog.
Yeah.
But like, that's literally the example of white privilege is you go get over it. Because for you, not you, but you know, yeah. For the guy saying it, things have always been chill. So you think, well, things have always been chill. I mean, they're chill for you too, right?
Yeah.
It's like, no, we're living in different realities. Like, you're not living in the same reality that they're living in. They're living in a reality where they were born into a family that the grandmother was involved in segregation, and the great-great-grandmother was a slave. And so
yeah.
It's not like it just stopped at some point. It's not like at the end of any of these things somebody, like, wiped some dry erase board clean and were like,
it was
right,
still
over.
There. It's like tattoo removal.
Yeah.
Like, there's still remnants of the old tattoos. And
right.
Despite the fact that you got one on the neck off, you still have two on your hands.
Right. I mean, it's like, well, we go, well, why are there so many? Why is there so much crime in a black neighborhood? Well, let's ask the question. My biggest pet peeve is it seems like the liberal blogger world right now, the Jezebel.com kind of like don't make that kind of joke police. What they want is for us. They want for us to be uncomfortable to talk about things, honestly.
Oh, my God. Don't get me fucking started. That, for me, I used to talk a lot about race on
yeah.
stage. A lot.
Yeah.
And unapologetically and never
right.
fearful and always honest. And I would have old black men consistently coming up to me going, don't stop doing what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And then it got to a place where I was like, wow, you can get in trouble for not even being mean.
Right. Just talking.
And
just being.
Just talking. And talking is the way to get it. Like, once you get white people, and I say corporate white America,
yeah.
to be terrified to even have the conversation, there's an
yeah.
impasse. It's never going to get better.
The ultimate example is like, there's this current, I don't know how, I follow this stuff pretty closely, but there's this current thought within the kind of activist-y community, which is that there's no such thing as racism against white people. That doesn't exist. So let me just explain that concept, right? Reverse racism is a concept that, by its definition, cannot exist because, according to this school of thought, racism requires power. You have to be empowered and be for racism to exist, it has to be disempowering a person. So therefore, reverse racism is a contradiction in terms. Now, leaving aside the definition of racism, which does not mention, I mean, this is a completely concocted intellectual, like, you know, college campus, you know, make them up. I mean, they just made that idea up that you need to be powerful to be racist. According to the definition of racism, racism is just, you know, believing that one race is superior or inferior to another or discriminating on them. But whatever. Yeah. Leaving that aside, it's like, okay, there's a very popular joke online right now by a stand-up. I forget the guy's name. And it's a good joke, by the way. It's just based on this premise that there's no such thing as reverse racism. So he says, you know, people often complain about what I do on stage, and they say, well, aren't you just being a revert about white people, what I say on stage about white people? And they say, aren't you just being a reverse racism, a racist? And he goes, well, I could be a reverse racist, but I would have to. And then he goes through this very complicated, it's a good bit.
Yeah.
You go back in time.
Who is it? Where? How can I find it? I
don't know the fucking guy's
name. Black dude?
We could find it out. But
no, keep going.
But I'd like to drop it so you can watch it, because it's a good bit. He's a talented guy. He's funny, and it's a well-thought-out joke. He goes, get into a time machine, invent a time machine, go back in time, start, go right before white people came and colonized, blah, 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 and I would then instead colonize them, and then I would set them up in a system of oppression that would blah, 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 and then I could be a reverse racist. It's a very good bit, but it's a flawed premise, because it's like, it's all based on the idea that there's no such thing as reverse racism because of their rejection of the nomenclature, the word reverse racism, or that it matters, or I don't know what exactly, but it gets you to this place where you go, okay, from my perspective, it's like, okay, there's no such thing as being racist against white people, but then let's make a new, can we talk about, you know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When a black dude comes up and says, you white bitch, like, you know what I'm talking about. Even if it's in a system of empowerment where it doesn't matter as much as if a white guy says, you black bitch.
Call it Larry. He's being so Larry right now.
Yeah, something.
But give it a name.
But they want to, the discussion wants to be like, no, that doesn't exist. Well, you know what I'm talking about. No, that doesn't exist. It's like, okay, but we're trying to have a conversation here. No. It's like, okay, fine. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I'm stuck. So I sort of feel like, you know, I want to be able to have I'm a white dude, right? I'm Jewish, so I'm a little bit off white, but I'm still a white dude. So I get that it's not like, you know, oh, poor me, you know. I would say that reverse racism doesn't matter as much as regular racism, because I think what they mean is like reverse racism, like if somebody comes up to you and says, you white bitch, you go like, and it ruins your day. But then you go, you know, you go not get pulled over
go
by the cops.
Go play tennis.
You know, but regular whatever racism is just a systemic part of like an entire system. I get it. It's worse. Racism against black people has more powerful impact.
I will say this. How about this? How about with children?
Mm-hmm.
There is, like, children could be racist or even reverse racist to each other. So hypothetically speaking,
right,
say a group of Chinese kids all go to Chinese school on Saturdays. It's something they do. Our friends are Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter wants to go. And they say, no, you can't. You're white, honky.
Right.
Go home.
Right.
Well, they're saying that doesn't exist, that my daughter wasn't – there was no reverse racism in there. But my daughter has no power over a Chinese kid her same age.
Right. But I think their point is – and I don't know for sure, but because it's not my opinion. But I think their point is like, it doesn't matter. It hurt your daughter's feelings, but it's not connected to any larger – it has no meaning.
It doesn't then define them.
Right,
it
they don't.
It
your daughter's not going to take that. Probably take that lesson and go stuff it into herself and go it does mean it is shitty to be white. And then the next interaction she has and then eventually she's an adult walking around like nobody wants a white girl around.
Damn,
you know what
it,
I mean?
Man.
Which is true. Nobody wants a white girl around. You know what I mean?
No, I'm on.
But what you describe is a real thing that happened.
Yeah,
so, you know, it's like. Okay.
By the way, those Chinese kids didn't say that to my daughter because those are our friends. But I'm just saying, had that happened.
They said, like, Choi Chin Chow or whatever.
Yeah.
Guys, I'm sorry.
Miho Kai Lin, bitch. So,
but I think the biggest problem right now is that, and this is what's real interesting, because how old are you?
41.
41. So you're, you grew up in the same sort of, I'm 34, but still, we remember the time, especially listening to hip hop, where young activist people were fighting against conservative stuff shirt censor people like Tipper Gore and, you know, Focus on the Family.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were out there for like, oh, we can say anything we want. You know, Ice-T can say Cop Killer and Jello Biafra can say, And then somehow the young people, not that I'm not young and you're not old, you know, but it's like we're not the young people, the young generation. Somehow the young generation become these fucking weird censorship thought police that Tipper Gore was saying, like, oh, I'm not saying it's censorship. I'm just saying it's this is affecting people and we shouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah.
It's the same exact language that these conservative, that the Tipper Gore, the Focus on the Family people had. But now it's like some blogger with like a, you know, a patchwork skirt on and like, you know, librarian glasses. It's like, well, I'm an activist. Like
I said to, I'll tell you the exact story. We were shooting something for Travel Channel. We were doing a bike bomb, meaning like we take bikes from the top of a hill in Portland all the way down to the bottom. And I'm very sensitive to everyone at all times. Regardless, but when we're working with Travel, I definitely have my hat on to make sure that I represent the network in a positive light. I don't curse. I'm not. But that's because we started doing Birth Conqueror. Mm-hmm. It was more like a for children. We were at theme parks. So this girl gets into an accident and causes a pretty big accident. And they're all very hipsters. They're all what you're kind of saying. I say hipsters. They're very nice people, and I had a really great time with them. Right. But I'm just telling you what happened. This girl gets in an accident, causes a big accident. One guy loses his tooth, and everyone's really – fucking total wreck. We're going 40 miles an hour on kids' bikes.
Right.
And I am concerned, and I go over, and she has a huge strawberry on her arm.
Right.
And she's probably 23, I'd say. And I went, honey, are you okay? And she lost her shit. She goes, don't fucking call me honey, and don't touch me. And I was like, wow, I don't know. I didn't,
right.
I really, in the moment is what I said. Now I'm 41. I grew up in a different time than she did 20 years after. I don't know what to say to her. I wasn't going to call her. I actually thought of this after. I wasn't going to call, I would never refer to her as Miss.
Right.
Because I'm hanging out with her. I'm doing something active with her. It's not that informal. She's not my waitress.
Right.
I'm not going to refer to her as Toots or Ma'am. Ma'am's disrespectful.
I can tell you what the blogger would say.
What?
What would you have said to a guy that happened?
Dude.
Yeah, or hey,
dude. I would have said no. I would have been, dude. Are you okay? That's exactly what I said to the other guy.
Right.
I go, dude, are you okay?
Right.
And he didn't go, don't call me dude.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a dude.
Right.
I read books. Dudes don't read books.
Well, you know what's unfair about that interaction is like, I get a woman saying,
by the way, I was in the wrong.
Right.
I was
but
in the
she
wrong,
and supposed that. Not only that you should have known better, but you should have known better and had all of the context necessary for why that felt offensive to her.
Yes.
She presupposed that you should have gone to all of the feminist women's studies classes she's been to, read all of the books, and had all of the information, and you knew all that, and decided, fuck it, I'm going to call this bitch honey. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In your mind. But it's not true. And it's like, a person in that situation can say, you know what, I don't like being called honey.
Yeah,
you know,
completely. There's a guy, his name's Colonel, and I hung out with this guy a lot. And his real name's Colonel, by the way.
Yeah.
But it's like K-E-R-N-L. Uh-huh. And he embodies like the fuck it attitude of owning going to Burning Man.
Sure. Uh-huh.
He really goes to Burning Man and fucking goes there for the art installations.
Right.
But and he's a cool guy. I'll fucking get his name on Twitter and I'll tweet it. But and me and him have kept in touch somewhat. But he said to me, I said, he goes, it's just an outdated term.
Yeah.
He goes, I'm just giving you a heads up. You just can't call someone honey. He's my age. Colonel's my age. And he was, and I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, I know you didn't mean anything wrong with it, but it's outdated. And I apologized profusely to her and him. She still had a fucking, she was still really upset with me. And I don't think I ever got past that.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, let's take a nod for a fucking 41-year-old man to apologize profusely to a 23-year-old female who is inconsequential in my life. I don't really need to apologize.
Right.
I can just walk away and go, well, that interaction sucked.
Right.
But I didn't, and I apologized. She didn't even acknowledge
I'm sorry,
it.
Sorry, bitch, are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah. But I didn't know what to call her, and
so
I was
she
like,
she never.
She was never.
I'm gonna be honest
never,
with you.
Yeah.
She seems awful.
She was.
I mean, you learned a nice lesson.
Yeah.
And you won't do that again. She seems terrible. But
she also did just wreck pretty bad and was all scratched up. So her adrenaline was probably flying. There's a lot of things that I could forgive.
No, I'm going to say she's terrible. But but it's interesting. I'm thinking right now, it's like you probably won't ever do that again, huh?
No, never.
I wonder if...
That's the thing. I won't ever talk to a woman that's younger than me if I don't know what to say to them first, if I don't know their name.
Would you ever finger a woman that's younger than you? Your wife... she's not going to know.
She's older.
Or she's giving you permission. Or
no,
in this
I have
world,
no, I don't. Can I be honest with you? This is going to sound horrible. I don't feel like vocal cords should develop until you're fucking 28.
Just
like,
for anybody.
I don't. Yeah, I don't. Anybody. I don't want to hear much of what super young people have to say. 23. I'll take 23.
Right.
Like I just feel like those thoughts are thoughts
that
are not
formed. What if those were her first words? She was 23. She was like, "Don't tell me, honey, you piece of shit."
No, I probably it did change the way I will interact with people,
I'm
but it just made me out of fear.
I know. I mean, it's terrible. That just sounds terrible. It's like there's a lot of people, transgendered people, who they will people that were born into one gender and then feel that they were born into the wrong gender, so they switch or they go through a process of switching, and they prefer a new pronoun, right? They prefer your friend Ben now wants to be called Becca and would like you to call her she now.
Yeah.
And which is, look, that's intense for a person, especially, I mean, I'm from the Bay Area, I'm young, you know, like, and it's hard for me to sometimes wrap my mind around. I can only imagine what the rest of the world feels. So I feel like it should always be like, hey, I mean, look, and I'm not, I know, again, I'm not trans, I don't know what it means to really go through this, but I feel like it should always be like, hey, look, I know this is going to be intense for you, I know it's going to be weird for you, but I've decided this, and I'm going to, and I would prefer, and I know, but it would be respectful if you adjust. But the vibe often will be like, it's her, okay? And it's like, but wait, you've changed reality. Give me some time.
Yeah.
I need to catch up. Like, you've changed everything. Yeah. Maybe I'm ignorant, but I'm still living in the ignorant world that I was born into. So give me, like, a little compassion. But then I think that the counter argument, and I bet you this is what that girl would say. She'd probably would just, like, an awful person and also hyped up on adrenaline, would be, I'm tired of having to calmly explain to a man why he shouldn't call me honey.
Yeah.
I've been called that my whole life. I don't give a shit if it hurts your feelings. I mean, I bet that that's the vibe. I'm tired of, you know, I've been called, you know, faggot and, you know, shim and shemale my whole life. Well, I don't care anymore if it makes you uncomfortable. Call me fucking her, you know?
Yeah.
I imagine that's the counter.
I've never had to struggle up.
Right.
So I don't know that. Right. So it's interesting because I'm coming from a perspective of never having to struggle up, never being called honey or toots or sweet tits.
Right.
And so people just refer to me as sir.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what that's like. So I can't even empathize. So, but I'll tell you what, I'm glad it happened because it's interesting.
Yeah.
But more importantly, I'll never call a female honey. In the South, it's so acceptable.
Right.
Like, but, and I'll never call a female honey.
Well, it's interesting because I'm thinking about myself. I would never call a woman honey. Just instinctively.
I didn't know how to.
Different. You're from Florida. It's a whole different thing. I'm just thinking about myself. I would never do that. Although, and maybe this is a way we can wrap this up. When I was young, I used to very much pretend to be black. You know, I mean, I just straight up did.
Yeah.
Like I said, the apex predator of the social scene was the black guy. And so when I was like 16, I'm like just straight up, you know, affected a black accent, you know, like, and it would ebb and flow depending on who I was talking to. So if I was talking to my brother, I'd be like, well, anyway, we're going to go. I mean, I didn't talk like that. You know, we're going to go to the store. And then,
wait, you did black impressions of white people?
A white guy. I'll do Richard Pryor's impression of a white guy. Hey, how's it going, Hoyt? I would just be talking like, oh, yeah, anyway, I'm going to go to the store. And then I get a call from my friend. I pick up the phone and be like, hello? Yeah, what's up, man? Yeah, all right, cool, peace. And hang up the phone. My brother would be looking at me like, what the fuck are you doing? But one time we were at this restaurant, and this was right when I was, like, changing. I got sober, and I was, like, starting to, like, reexamine my relationship with, like, you know, me thinking I was a gangster and all this. I was like, so I was in the middle of this introspection. We were at this cafe at, like, 2 in the morning. And this black lady comes over. She's like pouring us coffee. And I'm like 15 years old, 16 years old. And I just go, I'm like, thank you, baby. Like that. Like an old black man. It felt real, but I didn't know. It was. And I look over, my brother's just like, don't you ever fucking do that on me.
Thank you, baby.
Thank you, baby. But I didn't mean, anything. I was like, thank you, baby.
Hey, can I play against some conversation?
Hey, thank you, baby.
Hey, thank you, baby.
Hey, keep it warm, honey. All right. Anyway, so.
That was a fucking. I got to have you back, man.
Yeah,
I could talk to you for fucking hours.
I'll come back anytime.
I literally, we've been trying to make this work for so long, and I mean, we talked for an hour and a half, but I, one of the few people that I could talk to forever. You're just one of the most interesting dudes.
His book,
you can still get it. I know I can.
Kasher in the Rye.
Kasher in the Rye.
Also, I have a stand-up special on Netflix, an hour special, Moshe Kasher, live in Oakland. Or you can buy it on Amazon. I got DVDs. And can I plug a couple dates?
Please. I might post this one today.
Oh, cool. Yeah. The 19th to the 22nd of January, I'll be in Toronto at the Comedy Bar. And then New Year's. Have you been there?
No, but I have a big Toronto fan base.
Oh, shit. Toronto.
Yeah.
Come through.
You got it's too bad you're sober. There's a great club called The Underground.
Oh yeah, well, hey, you know, I'll go.
Well, you can't really go in there without experiencing it. So.
All right, there we go. What is it? A sex club?
It's a smoking bar.
Ah, I see.
And so Benson was like,
"Down
your
set list." Oh no, I'm doing
list.
A show there.
Are you really?
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm doing their like weed show or whatever.
Puff Mama.
Hopefully, I'll still be sober at the end of that.
We'll Benson was like, write down your notes. Ari was like, write down your set list. And I was like, guys, I'm not gonna smoke.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'll be fine. And 5 minutes on stage, and I'm like, oh, the lights are twinkling pretty fun.
Whoa.
Yeah, and then your throat starts hurting because it's so much fucking smoke.
Jesus,
but it's one of the funnest fucking shows I've ever done.
Yeah, and then San Francisco will be at the Nob Hill Masonic Auditorium New Year's Eve. That'll be fun.
Who are you doing that with?
I think Benson, actually, and Pete Holmes and Natasha and maybe Rory Scovel, some other people. It'll be really fun.
And me.
Oh, are you doing it?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes, I'm doing
awesome.
It too.
Oh, and who cares, man? They're coming anyway. I don't even need to plug that day. Yeah, oh, cool. Nice.
That's going
to
be fun. That's going to be a fun fucking time. My book, I never knew what they are. Publisher, editor, guy
editor,
that I deal with, is going to be there. He's bringing his brother.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yaniv. So I think he's excited to meet you.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
And then what? I think there's a couple other. Oh, I'm going to Charleston, South Carolina, January 17th through 19th for their comedy festival. Anyway, I'm done. But come, yeah,
and listen to the Champs on iTunes.
That Moshe Kasher, all that.
Rate and review it.
Do that.
Subscribe, rate, and review. It's so important to these podcasts.
Yep. And do it for this one, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You might as well do it for this one, too, if you haven't already.
Sure. Thank you, honey. Thanks for having me on, honey.
So big player.
This episode was brought to you by The Machine.